The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Camilla Ruse, sitting in for Alok Jha. On the show this week...
The population, the human population, has grown so enormously. You know, there are three times as many people on this planet as there were when I started making natural history programmes.
They say you should never meet your heroes, but when your hero is Sir David Attenborough, then it's probably worth the risk. We hear from Sir David about his 60 years as a naturalist and filmmaker. And
they're highly intelligent and they have huge brains for their body size. And indeed, my husband Nathan Emery calls them feathered apes for that reason, because they're so clever.
Professor Nikki Clayton will be giving us an insight into the minds of birds and why we humans might not be the only animals with the capacity for imagination.
Speed and skill at this time are imperative. Liston was meant to be able to remove a limb in 30 seconds.
And I'll be discovering the gruesome origins of modern-day surgery at the Museum of London's new exhibition, Doctors, Dissections and Resurrection Men. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. For millions of natural history fans spanning at least three generations, Sir David Attenborough has been a bridge to our understanding of the natural world. From the deep oceans to the ice caps, from the Serengeti to the rainforests of Borneo, he has witnessed and captured the magnificence of the planet that we live on and brought it into our living rooms. So, into his 60th year as a naturalist and broadcaster, it was an honour to meet with the great Sir David Attenborough this week. I started out by discussing the incredible advances in our understanding of the natural world and asked him which scientific discovery, in his opinion, had made the biggest impact.
I think the thing that has really revolutionised zoology and certainly my understanding of the natural world has been the recognition that the continents drift, continents move. Amazingly enough, when I was at university, which was in the 40s, it was not accepted in Cambridge University that the continents drifted. And I was asked to, as an undergraduate from the Undergraduate Geology Society, to go and ask the professor, why will you not tell us about this possibility? And he said, when anybody can demonstrate that there's a force that can move a continent by a millimetre, I will consider it. Until then, it's moonshine. But of course, the moment you know that continents drift, the whole of the history of life is transformed and makes sense. The convoluted arguments that were made in my undergraduate days to explain why Australia had marsupials and the rest of the world, or most of the rest of the world, didn't, were you couldn't believe how, and I couldn't understand them. I remember thinking, I must be very dim, but I don't understand how this works. And of course, it was a nonsense. And we know now, because of continental drift, all these things. And they make a whole sense of almost everything, really. It's a fundamental thing.
We're going to speak to Professor Nikki Clayton later, and she's been working on crows and their intelligence and also the fact that they can think, they can place themselves in the future. And have you ever seen that kind of behaviour when you've been filming animals?
Oh, yes. I mean, the New Caledonian crow is a well-known example of a bird which will actually manufacture a particular kind of tool in order to solve a particular kind of problem, which, of course, means that you have to be thinking about, if you're going to do that, you think, now, what I'm going to need is one of those sticks with a hook on the end, you know, and the crows can do that. They're marvellous Japanese crows which sit by traffic lights, and they collect nuts, and when the traffic stops they come down and they put the nut in front of the traffic, and then they go and wait for the lights to turn green, traffic goes along, rolls over the nuts and cracks them, and then stops again and the crows go down and eat the bits.
That's extraordinary.
In my time, scientists tended to downplay animal behaviour and to be extremely suspicious of crediting animals with abilities and sensitivities that they didn't have, or there's no evidence that they had. Year after year after year, we're discovering more and more and more that animals are cleverer than we thought, are more complex than we thought, and more individual than we thought. The notion that the spiders, for example, of the same species might have different characters was anathema, I mean, 50 years ago. And yet I know, I mean, from filming spiders, that you... we were wanting to film spiders doing one particular thing, hunting, by whirling a globule of sticky silk on the end of a thread. We assembled a whole group of spiders sitting in individual sprigs of vegetation. And the cameraman said to me, he said, this one is very idle, won't do anything. This one can't bear it if you make a noise. This one doesn't like light. But this one is an absolutely terrific girl. I mean, she will hunt no matter what you do. Now, they're all individual characters. That was unthinkable 50 years ago. And the more we know about the natural world, the more we realise that animals are more ingenious and more able and more fascinating and complex than we imagined.
And you've also travelled to an incredible number of places, and I think you've also seen firsthand the impacts that humans can have on the environment. Have you revisited a place that is very different now? You know, have you been to filmed in one place and then...
Oh, yes. And by and large, of course, since my job is to make films about the natural world, I go to where the natural world is flourishing rather than where it's been badly treated. But I was in Borneo last year, and I went up a river, which I'd travelled along 50 years ago, by the side of the river, for about 50 yards on the side, there's rainforest, a little gap, but beyond it, for mile after mile after mile, is nothing but oil palms. And of course, it's all very well for us to say how dreadful that is. But the fact is, the reason there are oil palms is that there is a world hunger for oil palms. The population, the human population, has grown so enormously. You know, there are three times as many people on this planet as there were when I started making natural history programs. It was a huge growth. And they need to be fed. And the people in Borneo are responding to that requirement, and so knocking down the rainforest and growing oil palms, and we all eat products of oil palms. But that's a straightforward result, consequence of audience of population growth.
How do we solve the population problem?
The only way I can think of it, is by giving women the rights to control their own bodies and to control how many children they have. And in every circumstance where women have that right, where they have the vote, where there are proper medical facilities, where they are literate, and where they are given the choice, the birth rate falls.
And there's been a record loss of sea ice this summer. Is the situation worse than scientists had been predicting or environmentalists have been talking about?
I think scientists very properly have been shy or cautious about scaremongering, and that's absolutely right and proper. So that if anything, they have underrepresented the dangers that in recent weeks the mechanics of melting glaciers has become more publicised, and suddenly people realise that it's not just as weather it gets warmer at the top. The complexity in which warm meltwater will actually flow down through holes in the, and erode the glacier from the inside it and lubricate the floor of it, suddenly you begin to realise, yes, glaciology is rather more complex than we thought, and that we are now understanding it in more detail and realising that actually the situation is worse than we thought, and the processes of melting are more volatile than we thought, that they are more complicated, and the ice cap is really melting much further than we thought.
Do we need to scaremonger a little now, or is that the wrong way
No, one shouldn't scaremonger. You don't need to scaremonger. The facts are alarming enough without scaremongering.
And how do you convince people to act?
Well, of course, people can't act, not really. The problem is a global scale. It's governments that have to act. That's a huge problem, because for the very first time in the history of Homo sapiens, we are asking people of different cultures in different continents with different languages, with different moral systems, to agree. Well, that's never happened in the history of humanity. And we can't suppose that it's going to happen just overnight. And we just have to keep at it and hope that the facts will be incontrovertible and be convincing in themselves.
Does it worry you that, for example, in the US presidential debates, there has been no mention of climate change? Does this surprise you?
It does worry me that the most powerful nation in the world, North America, is large proportions of it deny what the rest of us can see very clearly. I don't know what you do about that. I mean, the fact of it is, of course, it's easier to deny. Life is easier if you say, oh, well, it's not a danger. I wish I could say that. I mean, I would sleep safer at night if I thought that this was not a problem. It is a problem. It suits some politicians to say, don't worry about that. And they attract quite a lot of people who would like to believe that it's not a problem.
And what will it take to wake people up about climate change?
Disaster. It's a terrible thing to say, isn't it?
Sobering and wise words there from Sir David Attenborough, who told me that he's off to China to do some filming about fossils. And he's also about to finish a new series looking at the Galapagos in 3D. We wish him all the best. And to keep up to speed with his work, just go to his website. That's davidattenborough.co.uk. The 19th century was a revolutionary time for medical surgery. Anaesthesia, the discovery of germs, and the Anatomy Act all helped transform the discipline. But these developments had murky roots. Before it was legal to dissect bodies for study, graveyards were haunted by men armed with wooden shovels and sacks. These were the days of the body snatchers. Such was the panic they spread that people were buried in coffins especially designed to stop surgeons from getting their hands on their insides. But without the fear of these so-called resurrection men, 19th century doctors might never have got the chance to study anatomy. I went to meet Jelena Bekvalak, curator of human osteology from the Museum of London, to find out more about the deadly beginnings of modern surgery. We're here in the bustling entrance hall of the Museum of London. Now, before we go down a floor into the exhibition itself, Jelena, could you tell us what the hordes of school children are here for?
The current exhibition is Doctors, Dissection and Resurrection Men, and it's based around archaeological evidence from a site that was done in 2006 at the Royal London Hospital. It revealed a burial ground that had somewhat been forgotten in the maps that were present. And it was particularly interesting because it was of a key period in time, and it was in use from 1825 to 1841. And that was a really very important point for medical and social implications, because in the midpoint of that was the Anatomy Act of 1832. It revealed 262 burials that had a mixture of whole individuals, body portions and dissected elements, and showed evidence of post-mortem examinations where you're trying to look to see what was the cause of someone's death, dissection for teaching, and also comparative anatomy as well, so animals that were also used and cut in a similar way to the humans. So really fascinating insight of a particular time and of a functioning 19th century hospital.
And the timing was especially interesting because they were dissecting before the Anatomy Act, but also after in the same sort of way, is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And that's what was really interesting, because when they found this, they wanted to try to see whether it's possible to see any difference in the use of the bodies pre the Anatomy Act or post the Anatomy Act. It was quite hard with the actual layout of the cemetery to pinpoint sometimes that this group of people were buried pre-1832 or after, but generally it would appear that the hospital was dissecting patients who unfortunately hadn't survived, or equally then hadn't been claimed, who were buried in this cemetery. So yes, they were sort of doing the same thing throughout that period of time, both pre and post the Anatomy Act.
And what exactly was the Anatomy Act?
Well, the Anatomy Act was legislation that was passed so that it legalised the use of bodies for surgeon anatomists. They didn't then have to have any relationship really with the resurrection men, and it meant that they could use unclaimed or friendless individuals for dissection. Now, it was meant to be that it covered absolutely everybody in society. It didn't mean, you know, if you were the highest of the high, the lowest of the low. What really it always, in truth, was going to be, unfortunately, was that the same as before. If you were vulnerable and you were poor, it was going to end up really being the poor that took the brunt. And it caused a real sort of outcry because, again, there was great fear associated with it, and that what was going to happen to you when you died. And this was a sort of a stigma, really, that went on for many years afterwards, because people were always very fearful of ending up in a workhouse or an asylum, which, when you died, meant that potentially, if you had family, they may not have the money to take you to bury you, or there may not be anyone there at all. So you would end up in this fate that you really feared most.
Okay, well, I think we'll be talking about a particularly notorious case later on, about the Italian boy, and before then it would be good to go and see the exhibition and learn about a particularly unusual case of dissection.
Right, well, you're looking here at a rather interesting cast of a gentleman called James Legg, and he was a convicted criminal who was executed because he'd murdered another Chelsea pensioner. And at the time, as an added punishment or humiliation, you could also then be dissected. But on this occasion, it was actually a group of artists who were interested in how the body fell on the depictions of the crucifixion of Christ. And so when he came down from the gallows, a surgeon anatomist called Dr. Carpew managed to get his body, and they then put him on the cross, so they crucified him. He was then flayed, so his skin was removed, and then he was cast, so that you can now see the position of the arms, the legs, the body, the detail of the muscles, how the body would have actually sort of been placed and fallen once it was on the cross.
And was this legal at the time?
At the time, no, because what's very key sort of around this early 19th century period is 1832 is the Anatomy Act, and that actually legitimised the use of bodies of people who were unclaimed or friendless. This was legal in the sense that from the time of Henry VIII, four bodies a year were allowed to be used for dissection, public dissection, in relation to the barber surgeons. It then went up to six a year, but that really wasn't enough. So you then start to get the rise of private anatomy schools, and with that, men called resurrection men who procure bodies. So in terms of using bodies by surgeon anatomists, that wasn't legal. But with this gentleman on this cast, he was actually procured in a manner from being a convicted criminal. So there's a sort of a slight sort of crossover there.
So could you be condemned to dissection?
Well, I suppose it was seen as a condemnation and a humiliation. It was that it was an added punishment. So if you've done something really abhorrent and heinous and you've murdered another individual, added to that, so it's sort of like, you know, a physical punishment and then a legal punishment, was that you could then be dissected and used and cut up. And that was very pertinent at the time, because part of the religious belief was that if you were sort of cut into pieces, you were then not able to rise on the day of judgment and resurrection. So it was very embedded in Christian beliefs at the time.
So was it incredibly difficult for surgeons to get bodies with this religious belief?
Well, you'd think it would be, but actually it probably wasn't, because at this time London was a really bustling metropolis. You've got lots of people coming in. There are lots of developments of London. You've got the dockworks, the railways being built. You've got a huge influx of people. And with that, you've also got a high risk of death and mortality. The burial grounds are very small, really, in relation to the parishes and the churches, and they were becoming incredibly overcrowded. And because of that, also being poorer, you're more vulnerable. You get either stacked coffins and burials or mass graves. And because of that, people like the resurrection men and body snatchers actually have got a very ready source of bodies that they can get very easily. And that means the surgeon anatomists equally can get a very good ready source of bodies.
Okay, well, let's look at it from a surgeon's point of view and go and look at some of the instruments. Okay, we're looking at a selection of surgical instruments, and apart from the saw, I'm not entirely sure what they do, what they were used for.
Yes, so there's a lovely array here. So in that set, it's actually an amputation set, and surgeons would have had their own sets of instruments. And you've got, as you say, an amputation saw that has serrated edges. You've also got knives and scalpels. What you needed to do was to actually remove the soft tissue around the area that you wanted to amputate, so that once you got down to the bone, that gave a clean surface for the action of the saw to be able to work effectively and efficiently. Speed and skill at this time were imperative, because you wanted to do everything in the fastest time possible, because you had no anaesthesia, patients were having to be held down, so it would have been really very brutal and very painful. Liston was meant to be able to remove a limb in 30 seconds, which you really needed. We've also got a rather interesting horseshoe shape contraption here with two red pads, and that was a tourniquet, because the other thing that you desperately didn't want to do was bleed to death, so that would have then tried to stem the flow of blood. And there's also four sets of what looked like rather nasty looking sort of pokers, but that cauterizing irons, and so they would have been used to try to seal the wound. So again, everything needed to be done very quickly and very sort of effectively, so that you're limiting the amount of time that patient is having to be held down, and the sort of invasive part of removing parts of your body.
How likely were you to survive an operation?
That's a really good question, actually. Well, the speed and the skill of your surgeon was paramount, so that obviously helped, and their knowledge of anatomy, so they aren't cutting into other vessels. Well, there are records from the Royal London Hospital. They've got fantastic archives, and I think Professor Harold Ellis probably felt that with some of these types of amputations, maybe between 25 to 50% of people probably survived. The problem is with the instruments that they weren't being sterilised, so you've got lots of bacteria on them, and also, you know, there's the infections also that other people may have and carry, so the likelihood wasn't great. Obviously this all improved as we move on through time, but people were pretty robust in the past. I'm quite surprised anyone survived anything, really.
And the body snatchers, they were finding bodies for the surgeons, and were the surgeons practising amputations and these kind of procedures on the corpses?
They would have done. They would have been sort of twofold, because you'd be using it for dissections so that you could actually learn about anatomy, learn about disease processes. But equally, yes, you would need to practice your skills if you were then going to carry out an amputation or an operation such as trepanation if you're removing a small section of skull. So yes, they would have used them for many sort of different purposes. Purely always to try to increase their knowledge and their skill and expertise in trying to treat patients, and hopefully, you know, for the greater good of everybody.
So without the body snatchers, would the Anatomy Act have ever been passed?
Well, I think the catalyst for that really was the case of our sort of London Burkers, Bishop Williams and May. Because there was such a great fear associated with your body being removed after death, it was something that really was abhorrent. There was this push that something had to be done, and so that was the catalyst when they tried to sell the body of a young boy to a surgeon, who actually alerted the police to the fact that he thought it was too fresh. Which is quite interesting, because he was doing something that was illegal, so he sort of raised that alarm. And so really for London, or for, you know, sort of England, it probably was the catalyst that pushed something like the Anatomy Act. There were different times when it was brought forward. 1828, there was a select committee to discuss it, but it was one of these things, it was sort of like, we know these things are going on, but actually let us maybe not think about it too much, because we need to learn, there's a means of doing that, do we really want to sort of bring it to more public attention? But obviously with the Resurrection Men and all the things that were happening, there was a mass sort of response, mass media to it, there was a great fear, so really Parliament were being forced to do something, and the Anatomy Act really was something that probably had to be done, because they had to be seen to be taking sort of some sort of stance. You also have the voice of the surgeons, they were pretty powerful at this point, and obviously they wanted to be legitimate. They didn't want to be seen to be associated with people like Resurrection Men, and so for them they really wanted it to be legal, so that what they were doing wasn't something that was illegal.
Could you tell us about the case of the Italian boy?
Yeah, so the case of the Italian boy is Bishop Williams and May were three men who Bishops and William Proddy did actually start off as resurrection men, but as with Burke and Hare weren't resurrection men, they were murderers. It was a pretty nasty, messy job trying to go to cemeteries, dig people up. It's quite hard work. So it's almost like, well, why bother doing that when you can just murder people? And so with them, it was interesting because they apparently would just sort of lure people to come back with them, probably with alcohol. Where they lived in Nova Scotia Gardens, they were quite sort of ramshackle cottages. They had a well, and it would seem that they, after they drugged them, would tie a rope round their feet and stick them down the well and drown them. The thing with doing that is that you're not damaging the body, so that was good because you didn't want to then sell damaged goods. And purportedly, this young boy that they tried to sell, from going to sort of witnesses and trying to get evidence, people were saying was an Italian boy. It would seem possibly from their confessions that it probably wasn't an Italian boy. It may well have been a young boy who'd come down with cattle from Lincolnshire, but it also highlighted the fact that he wasn't just one person that they had murdered. They'd obviously murdered several people. And this case was quite a sensational case. It was sort of like the Burke and Hare for Scotland. And in the end, Bishop Williams and May, they were convicted, but actually it was Bishop Williams that were executed. May, they decided they didn't have enough evidence to prove that he'd actually killed this young boy, so it was Bishop and Williams in the end who went to the gallows.
What happened to their bodies?
Well, the same fate as they had passed on to everybody else. They then were taken down from the gallows, and William Blizzard, who's actually associated with the London Hospital, they do a ceremonial cut as part of the surgeons, the Royal College of Surgeons, and then they were both sent to two different anatomy schools, and they then were dissected as they had sold other people to be dissected.
How much was a fresh body worth?
I believe from a lovely lady called Kirsty Chilton at the Old Operating Theatre, they could go for very high prices. An adult probably was about 8 guineas. They were known as subjects, and they were either large or small. Large would relate you're an adult, small you're a child. Or then if you were younger, they would actually measure you. But they could actually make a lot of money, and it was an awful lot more than any wages that people actually sort of got at the time.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That was a very grisly but incredibly interesting story. Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
For information on opening times and tickets for Doctors, Dissection and Resurrection Men, go to the Museum of London's website, museumoflondon.org.uk. Are humans the only creative animals on the planet? For years, we have assumed that imaginative thinking is unique to our species. But as David Attenborough has said, even spiders have personality traits. So it's no surprise that new research is putting that cosy idea of human supremacy into doubt. Nikki Clayton is the Professor of Comparative Cognition at Cambridge University, whose work is expanding our understanding of intelligence and imagination in the animal kingdom. Nikki has joined forces with the artist Clive Wilkins for a thought-provoking art and science lecture at the Royal Institution here in London. It has already happened, dear listener, but for the Science Weekly fans who could not make it along, we've asked them both into our studios. I started by asking them why they wanted to compare their different perspectives on creativity, and why understanding how animals think can help us to understand what it means to be human.
We're both interested in the subjective experience of thinking, and how important that is for understanding the interplay between cognition or thinking, creativity or imagination, and consciousness. And the fact that we can approach it from both a science and arts angle and really integrate the two. It's not that Clive is being an artist and I'm being a scientist and we're going down these parallel paths. They're really being interwoven together. And we have lots of discussions, and just letting our thoughts free flow triggers all kinds of interesting and really inspiring ideas that then go us further, making us realise that there are things that we hadn't thought about before, or not in quite that way, not in quite that configuration.
Could you define imagination for me?
Well, for me, I'd make the distinction between two ways of seeing the world. One is using the imagination system, and the other is using the knowing system. So, to give an example, we all know that the Guardian offices are located in King's Place, close to King's Cross train station. That's just a fact. It's just a piece of information. Whereas imagining what it would be like when I met you today in the Guardian offices requires so much more than just a knowing system. It required me to project my mind into a future time and actually imagine possible scenarios, what you might look like, what the offices might look like inside. You know, you can go on the web and see what it looks like from the outside, but then in your mind you create this whole rich tapestry of scenarios. And that's the difference. So the one is intimately built up with your identity, because you're creating all different scenarios, but they're very much seen through your eyes. You're the author of those imaginings, whereas the knowledge-based is largely selfless and timeless. It's just factual. And I think that's the difference between the imagining system and the knowing system.
The interesting thing is, I think, about human beings, is we define our world by the things that we see around us, the things that we experience, the things that we discover. And once we have a full set of equipment to make sense of our world around us, the first thing we try to do with that solid information is reinvent it. In fact, we're very good at imagining the invisible. That's a key thing that human beings are very, very good at.
That's fascinating. And I often, when I get angry with someone, I accuse someone of being unimaginative. And has there ever been a person without imagination? Is that possible?
Yes. Mm. There are patients that have terrible, debilitating brain trauma. A classic example would be after a motorbike accident, and they have damage to the hippocampus and various other parts of the brain. And these people are very striking. There's only a few cases. One of the most famous is a person called KC. And he was had a perfectly normal life, as far as anyone can tell, until he was 30. And he had this terrible motorbike accident. And ever since then, he's not been able to imagine or remember. He knows things about the future and the past, but he can't imagine either backwards or forwards in time. And can you imagine how debilitating that is? It would be like experiencing all these events and then having no record that they'd happened. And then as if somebody has just told you what happened, and you just have to take on spec this bunch of facts about this experience you had. So it takes all the subjective experience out of it. It just becomes this timeless, selfless information. So he was really close to his brother, who tragically died, and he has absolutely no memory of when he was told the terrible news. And he just says that he feels the same kind of blankness when asked to remember the past as he does when asked to imagine the future.
It's incredibly distressing, I think. It would be awful. And we often think that non-humans think in that way, that they live in the present. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on your point of view, is probably the fairest thing to say. I think the idea was most eloquently expressed by Robbie Burns in one of his poems, A Lament Called Ode to a Mouse. And in the story, it's dusk and he's just ploughed over a field mouse's nest, and he feels absolutely rubbish and riddled with guilt that through his careless, thoughtless actions, this poor little field mouse will surely die. And then all of a sudden, a thought pops into his head and he feels immense relief. And he turns to the mouse, and I can't do it in a Scottish accent, I'm afraid, but he says, "Still, thou art blessed compared with me. The present only touches thee, but oh, I backward cast my eye on prospects drear. And forwards, though I cannot see, I guess and fear." And I find it interesting because when you think about what Robbie Burns is saying, I guess he's really making two claims. One is that mice, and I presume he meant animals in general, are stuck in the present. They don't remember the past and imagine the future. But he's also thinking it's a blessing, because you'd have no regrets and no anxieties of the future. But looking at patients like KC, I strongly suspect that it's very far from a blessing. And my own view is that at least some animals are capable of remembering the past and imagining the future. And that's based on my view as a scientist and experiments we've done with members of the crow family that hide food for breakfast and seem to be able to plan ahead and remember the past. But whether they're doing it in the same way as we are, of course, is another question. How could we ever possibly know? In the absence of language, it's very difficult to be able to unpack the precise processes by which they think.
You've done experiments with crows and with children, am I right?
That's right, yes. Members of the crow family that include the ravens and jays. Sometimes they're called corvids.
Corvids, okay. And what was it about the corvid family that was so interesting?
Well, they're highly intelligent and they have huge brains for their body size. So in relative terms, their brains are as big for their bodies as a chimpanzee's. And indeed, my husband Nathan Emery calls them feathered apes for that reason, because they're so clever and so big-brained. And I've been working with these birds for a long time now, about 25 years, and we've been constantly surprised by how smart they are. And one of the behaviours that they do for a living is that they hide food. We call it caching. And they have remarkable memories for where they've stashed these caches. So a Clark's Nutcracker, for example, is thought to remember with about 90% accuracy the locations of about 30,000 caches in about 7,000 different places, because they put several caches in the same place. But you think 7,000 places, that's one bird, and over periods of 9 months. And so I was interested in whether or not there was any evidence that the birds could actually remember specific past experiences, and was able to show that, sure enough, jays can remember not only where they've hidden the food, but what kinds of food they've hidden where, how long ago, whether another individual was watching, and if so, who. So they really have remarkably detailed memories of specific past caching events. And what's more, that they can plan ahead. They can plan where to cache food for tomorrow's breakfast. And they can take account of what they will want when they come to recover their food. So they can really sort of think ahead and plan for future scenarios, as opposed to only being influenced by what they want now. And there's a sense in which, in that regard, at kind of ignoring what they fancy now in order to make a sensible choice for the future, in some ways they're actually better than we are. We all know the stories about how it's a bad idea to go to the supermarket and go grocery shopping when you're hungry.
I always do that. It's a terrible idea.
You know, your grocery bill is going to be much better if you wait until you're sated. And, you know, we know that it's going to change later, but it doesn't matter if you're hungry now. You just pack the trolley with all kinds of junk and then later feel rather guilty about it.
And do the crows not do this?
The crows are much better than us at taking account of ignoring whether or not they're hungry now in order to make the most rational decision for what they will want in the future.
That's incredible. So they imagine a future reality slightly better, than more accurately than we do?
Well, they are better able to dissociate from what they want now. And consequently, you don't see many obese crows.
Do children do this as well? When do they develop this ability?
Children develop the ability to think about the past and to plan for the future when they're about four. It's quite a gradual development, but it's not really until they're about four that they have a sense of tomorrow and yesterday.
So do crows learn this quicker than we do?
Well, I don't know, because we haven't looked at how quickly crows develop these tasks. All I know is that they have a very long development compared with a lot of birds, and it takes them ages to figure out how to cache properly. So they do really silly things when they're babies, like they love waxworms, the caterpillar of the wax moth. And baby crows will hide the larvae while the caterpillars are still alive. So of course Mr. Caterpillar does a bit of freedom across the ground. It's when they're older they figure out that actually if you're going to cache these things, it's a good idea to kill them. And the really clever ones have actually learned that the best thing to do is not to kill them, but to paralyse them by pinching the trigeminal nerves. Because then what you do is that they don't degrade so rapidly. It's kind of like, you know, frozen food.
And Clive, does it surprise you that non-humans have such imaginative capabilities?
I'm fascinated to find out about these things, yeah. And what I want to do is put myself in the position of some of these animals and how they're probably thinking in order to make some more connections for the work I'm doing myself.
The fundamental point here is that imagination is key to identity and to memory, really, how we remember and think of ourselves. And these non-humans are able to do this. So, you know, they may perhaps not to the same level that we can or in the same way, but they can do this.
Yes, it's about the difference between the subjective experience of thinking, in this case about past and future, versus just knowing stuff. It's where the whole idea of the label and identity came as well, that if you know stuff, it's like a label, it's selfless and timeless. With an identity, with an imagination, you write the memories, you create them yourself, and you create the plans and future scenarios. So the world is viewed through your eyes, and that's why it's subjective.
And remember, if you want to hear more from Clive and Nikki, then tune into their events podcast on the Royal Institution's website, rigb.org. To learn more about Nikki Clayton's work and her upcoming series with Clive, then follow her tweets at NikkiClayton22. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time, of course, on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Camilla Ruse, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.